Tu Sahanau Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvina Vahitamastu Mavishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Chapter 2, Section 2, Verse 1. Purame Kadashadwaram, Purame Kadashadwaram, Ajasya Vakrachetasaha, Ajasya Vakrachetasaha, Anushtaya Nishochati, Anushtaya Nishochati, Vimuktascha Vimuchate, Vimuktascha Vimuchate. Puram ekadashadwaram, so puram ekadashadwaram, ekadasha, so puram ekadashadwaram, ajasya avakra chetasaha, anushtaya nashochati, Vimuktaha cha vimuchate etat vaitat. Before that, before this verse, there's a little introduction to the verse, because we're starting a new chapter here. Sometimes he does an extensive introduction. This is just one sentence, but it's a nice one. Punar, I'll just read it to you and translate it just so you can appreciate it. Punarapi prakarana antarena Brahma tattva nirdharana artaha ayam arambaha durvijnayatvat brahmaha. So he says punarapi means like once again. Punarapi, once again, prakara antarena, by another prakara. Prakara means the teaching methodology, or another type of unfoldment. Antara means another. So prakara antarena. Brahma tattva nidharanartaha, for the sake of artaha, the nidharana means for the sake of the ascertainment, for the sake of, or for the purpose of ascertaining the Brahma tattva, the truth of Brahma, right? Another teaching methodology, a prakarana antara, by another way, in another form, by means of another method, ayam arambaha. It means this beginning means we're commencing on something new. So arambaha means the beginning. So now we have this beginning. It has the sense of we're commencing on something new chapter. Why? Durvignayatvat brahmanaha. Because of the difficulty in understanding Brahman. And it's not just understanding. Vignaya means that which has got to be known in terms of recognition. It's what we call aparoksha jnanam, where you have the direct, immediate recognition of your own presence, which is much different than an indirect knowledge about Brahman. This is vijnaya or vijnanam. Vijnanam is just an action noun, an agent or action noun. Vijnaya is that which is to be known in this way. So what is durvijnaya? That which is difficult to be known, difficult in terms of having this aparoksha jnana, this direct, immediate understanding. So because Brahman is really not available for vijnanam, you know, without difficulty, because all of our means of knowledge are meant to gain knowledge of what is within maya, what is within time and space. And so what means of knowledge do we have to differentiate the self from not only the experiences that I have, but the very means of knowledge that are giving me those experiences. So that's where this viveka needs to happen, and that's where it is not happening. It's not happening without some sort of means of knowledge. In fact, it's just a little bit more about this durvijnaya. If you happen to have like a samadhi experience, just a samadhi experience means where you just are experiencing, you don't know the words for it, but you're experiencing just the non-dual reality of being itself. You just happen to come across that experience for some reason. You know, it can happen, anything could trigger that. It's going to be a beautiful experience to have, but that's what it is, an experience. What is happening in that experience is that the mind is having the regular old vritti-vyapti. It means the mind has just resolved into its own being. But the mind is already, the mind and the being, the Satchitatma, are already completely present. They're already completely present. The mind, without needing to do any viveka, any discrimination between itself and its own content, just has an experience. So the mind has a non-dual experience, which translates into, the mind, has a non-dual experience, which is wonderful, and I know it's the truth, and I know that it's real, but I don't know what it is. I know that experience is the reality, but in terms of what it is in reference to the creation, in reference to me, in reference to God, in reference to everything, I know it's reality, I don't know what that means. I just know it experientially. No viveka necessary at all. And so the ahankara remains completely intact and has this wondrous experience that comes and goes. The experience of reality which comes and goes. And so then, because the mind has not, there's no pramana to differentiate the mind or this world from the self that illumines it, it's the ahankara is intact. And so then it says, how can I have this experience again? I know this is the truth, how can I get it back? We have the same kind of, it's called Jada Samadhi. Jada Samadhi means a samadhi that doesn't have any knowledge. There's no knowledge involved. There's an experience without jnana. Because there's nothing, there's no viveka between the mind and the experience. It's this, the mind, which is already the self, is now having a fantastic vritti. And that vritti comes and goes. And so the question is, how can I get that back? Just like any experience, whether it's a meditative experience or experience that's generated by pranayama, or however meditative experiences that are generated by one thing or another, they're wonderful experiences, they're beacon lights, they're meaningful, they keep you going because you know there's a truth out there, but it doesn't solve the problem of yourself. So the problem of that being yourself, for that viveka to take place, is what is difficult. So when we say durvignyayatvat, because of the difficulty in having that vignyayam, that direct immediate knowledge of the self as Brahman, right? The durvignyayatvat of Brahman. So it's not saying of the Atma even. It's saying there's two things involved here. It's the viveka between between the mind and the self, but it's also another, there's a whole other level. It's not just that a differentiation between the mind and the self, it's then the recognition that yourself is non-dual. There's a jump that has to take place there, because once you recognize yourself as non-objectifiable, just self-evident consciousness, now there's something more that you have to know. Because if you're self-evident, non-objectifiable consciousness, how can there be two of you? You're not an object within time and space. There's no subject-object relationship. There's just non-dual conscious being. And so that being the case, the next thing that has to be recognized is there's only one of me. Because there can only be two within duality. There can't be two outside of duality. And not only that, what we consider to be duality has to be mitya. Why? Because it's for a myriad of reasons. But one is just the mere fact that it's objectifiable and it is not self-evident. It's not swaprakasha. That means its very being depends upon consciousness. Consciousness for its existence and consciousness for its knownness. Unless it itself is swaprakasha, self-luminous. But that's never the condition. There's nothing that talks back to you. You illumine, you're the luminary of everything. You don't experience, you never experience a dual consciousness. And if you think you do, because I'm talking to you and you're talking to me, Then when we do that viveka, we recognize that the ones that are talking are both mitya, and themselves are not self-evident. So there's so many, there's a whole myriad of different prakriyas. In fact, almost every prakriya that we use, once we've established the non-dual nature of myself, is used to establish the mityatva of the creation, and the creation is one non-dual Ishwara. One non-dual Ishwara, because mitya and depending upon the self. So anyway, I don't want to go out in all these directions. So that this dvidyayatva, the difficulty of really recognizing myself as Brahman, means that we have to, Upanishads have to teach it in many different ways, not just one. It's not just one Upanishad. You know, there's a whole teaching tradition. Each Upanishad is complete in itself, but then each Upanishad puts the emphasis in a little bit differently to help you see the whole same vision, but from this aspect. And then to see the vision from this aspect where more things are highlighted. You know, so there's a lot of teaching that goes in to this, so that this aparoksha jnanam, or this recognition of myself, is complete. And so this is how he introduces this verse, which has some really beautiful parts in it. So he says, Purim is a city of Puri, Puri of Purim. This is a city which is Ekadasha. Ekadasha means 11. Dwaram means gate. So Purim, Ekadasha Dwaram, it's an 11-gated city. It means it has 7 entry ways to enter and exit. And so this 7 gates, what they're considered to be in the head, they're 7. 2, 4, 6, 7. Right? 2 eyes, 2 ears, 2 nostrils, 1 mouth. That's 7. Then there are 3 exit holes. So the urethra, the anus, and they also consider the belly button. Mm-hmm. The navel is one. That's interesting. That's 10. And the 11 is the top chakra, where the soul exits at the time of death, and maybe enters also.
How many gates? 7 or
11? 11. There's sometimes they do a 7-gated city, but this time they're doing 11. So, and these are the 11 possible things you can conceive of. So this 11-gated city is the sharira, this physical body. So this Purim, Ekadasha Dwaram, this 11-gated city of Ajasya, Janata, Ajasya, of the one who is unborn, the Atma, Brahman, of the self, of the unborn one, who is Avakra Chetasaha, who is consciousness which is Avakra, not crooked. So then you think, oh, how could consciousness be crooked in the first place? But the example they use for it is beautiful. You know how the sun, the rays of the sun are eternal within time and space. They're eternal and they're straight. They don't wander all about. They just are. So there's straight lines in all directions. So there's no, the idea is they're changeless. They don't waver. They don't change or bend or be subject to time and space, for instance. Nothing disrupts them. They just simply are. So like that, Brahman simply is conscious being. It's straight. It's not crooked. It's not bending or curving, from their experience anyway. So, in terms of the sandrishtana, so for this ajasya, for this self, which is what we would say in English, which is just pure consciousness, nothing but consciousness. So this avakra-cetasaha, or this self, this 11-gated city of this self, anushtaya, having contemplated upon it, anushtaya, na-shochati, one does not grieve. So having contemplated on this 11, on the 11-gated city of the one who is free from birth, and who never goes through any mortification, one does not grieve. That person is vimuktaha, is liberated. Vimukta, who is liberated, that person who does not grieve is liberated. And vimuchit, who is liberated. So we say in English like this. This one, having contemplated on the birthless one in this nine-gated city, this vimuktaha, this person, does not grieve. This liberated person does not grieve, and this liberated person is liberated. This liberated person does not grieve. This liberated person does not grieve and is liberated. So then you have to know, well, how can the liberated person, why does the liberated person have to be liberated? So that all has to be unfolded. But that's the verse. So there's a couple of things here I want to go through that are really pretty beautiful. Shankara, in this first part of the commentary, he makes clear this vision. In a city, if you just imagine a city, and it has all of these entryways and exits, it also has many things going on in the city. There's commanders in the city, and the people who have all, who do all different types of jobs and administration in the city, and many people wandering about through the city. And so that makes the city, and the city is functioning as a unit with many, many different parts. But then there's the king of the city. And the king of the city is really separate from the city. In other words, he's not an appendage of the city, he's the ruler of the city. And so the king can come in and out of the city. In reference to the city, the king of the city is asanga, unattached, you know? Where the parts of the city are like, he views the city like the physical body. The physical body has so many jobs, so many parts, so many organs, so many things going on to make this body work as a whole unit, you know? But the Atman, the self, as the king of the body, right, comes and goes, it's asanga. It's not dependent on the body for its being, as though the ruler of the body is the idea. But what they're saying is it's asanga. It's not a part of the body, and yet it's the ruler of the body. It's the indweller of the body. It's the self of the body. It's the one for whom the body is. You say, it is your body. It is the body of the conscious being who indwells the body, right? So the indweller of the body, the conscious being who resides in the body, is the Atman, is the self of the body, but is also free of the body, just like the king is free of this nine-gated city. That's kind of the idea. So they go in a great deal, a lot of detail on that. She says, so there's something important that Shankara brings out. I haven't seen him. Like Swamiji brings this out all the time, but it's nice to see Shankara do it. What it says here, okay, this nine, for whom, having meditated, let's see, the Purim Ekadasha Dwaram, Ajasya Avakrachetasaha, Anushtaya. This is what Shankara says here. Yesya, for whom, idam puram, for whom there is this city. Yesya, idam puram, tam, that one, Parameshwaram, the Lord, Puraswaminam, who is Who is the one who is the Lord of the city? Parameshwara, the Lord, who is the Puraswaminam, the Lord, the master of the city. This is the thing. Anushtaya. Anushtaya means dhyatva. Having meditated upon that, having contemplated upon that. Now he says, dhyanam hi tasya anushtanam. This dhyanam, because the dhyanam, the meditation of, on this, the meditation of that, of the Lord in that way. Now he says, samyak vijnana purvakam, which is preceded by samyak vijnanam. Samyak vijnanam, so this meditation on the Lord, on Anishwara, who is the Swami of the nine-gated city, is preceded by clear vijnanam, doubt-free vijnanam. Vijnanam means direct, immediate recognition of the self. So then the question is, why would I have to meditate on myself if I have samyak vijnanam, if I have clear knowledge of myself, then do I get clear knowledge of myself and then I have to go meditate on it for what? Because I already am that. Vijnanam, it's not just jnanam, it's not indirect knowledge. I have direct, immediate knowledge of myself. So preceded by direct, immediate knowledge of myself, having meditated on that, nisochati, that one does not grieve. So what is this, that I gain this knowledge of myself and then I go meditate on myself? Is that necessary? That doesn't really make any sense. And so Shankara says, what is that? He says, sarva eshana vinirmuktaha sanyat. He says, being completely free, right? Being completely free of all desire, nishojati. He does not grieve. So this is the thing. For a person who comes to this knowledge as an uttama adhikari, completely free with the highest degree of vairagya, remember, to be an adhikari for this knowledge, you need viveka. You need to have some discrimination. That all, at least you have to recognize all of this is finite. None of this. There's nothing in my experience, including my body, my mind, my sense organs, the whole universe, nothing is capable of giving me any type of lasting ananda, fullness, completeness, because it's subject to change. And so from the creation, including the knower and the known, the whole dvaita is incapable of giving any lasting happiness or fullness or completeness to me. So say I've recognized that to the nth degree before I get to this knowledge. And having recognized that, I gain vairagya. Because of that recognition of viveka, I gain vairagya. And the vairagya is complete. You know, you can have a very, very high degree of being an adhikari, a qualified student, when you come to this knowledge. So I can be free from desires. If this is not going to make me happy. This is not any, it does not have the capacity to fulfill me, and so I've lost then my taste for it. You know, and I become, because of that, a mumukshu. That's why. Otherwise I'm not going to be, I don't qualify as a mumukshu, because a mumukshu is really the one who recognizes I can't gain what I long for from this world or from this body, mind, sense organs, or for the subject-object relationship within duality itself. It is not possible. And so what if I emotionally assimilate that? I get it in terms of viveka, but vairagya means I'm emotionally assimilating it. But no, I don't want this. This is not what I want. And then I become a mumukshu because I realize that it's impossible for me to get what I want as a knower using my pramanas and my organs of action in order to complete myself in this world, that is not possible. So I throw my hands up to Bhagavan and say, if you are there, please save me. Because, this is why, because I've had moments, moments of recognizing that I am more than that, that there is something else. So those are those beacon lights. I know there's something. I don't know how to get that. And I'm not going to be able to get it because I can't get it from anything in the world. So I gain a level, as a mumukshu, as an adhikari, I gain a level of maturity, enough of a maturity, enough viveka, enough vairagya, enough mumukshutvam to warrant a teacher. It's enough. But what happens is, as I gain this knowledge, and I gain this samyak means a very clear, without any doubt, vijnanam, direct recognition of myself, having gained the pramana, having gained the teacher, having gained the teaching of the shastra, I gained that knowledge, but there's some hangovers. And the hangover is what we call, because I can take care of so much for clarity, I can take care of the shravana. I can gain clarity in terms of the vision itself that the Upanishad has to give. Through manana, I can knock off all and every other position and just logically annihilate it. I can get rid of it. So I know this is what it is. I see it. I understand it. But there's still what we call dehatma buddhi. And for the elimination, the complete nivritti of the dehatma buddhi, that conviction that I am the self, that is habitual. And that can have a lag time. And also any, you know, desires and conscious material that continue to come up from the unconscious, things that haven't been worked through because of whatever my situation is, whatever my mumukshutvam is, or the adhikaritvam, or the degree of clarity that I have at that time, are certain things that need to be resolved, that have to come up in the light of my knowledge. So part of it is the strongest thing is the dehatma buddhi. When we're talking about nididhyasana, contemplation, it's that conviction that the body is the deha, which I have had from beginningless lifetimes. That conviction is very firm. So I have the shravana, manana, and then all of this type of unconscious habitual ignorance that comes up that needs to be knocked off by the nididhyasana. If it does. It's not necessary, but Swamiji will say, yeah, but in this yuga it's necessary. In Shweta Ketu, in the Chandogya Upanishad, when Shweta Ketu is taught by his father, he's taught the Mahavakya Tetramasi 9 times. I think it's 8 or 9 times. And it's over. It's completely over. Because all of these things had already been taken care of.
Wow.
His mind is ready for that. But for the most part, it's not just shravana manana. It's shravana manana nididhyasana. And nididhyasana is meant to take care of these things that are in, now how we would say it, these things that are Indian conscious that have to present themselves to your knowledge. They have to present them. The unconscious has to present itself to you, the one who now has knowledge. You know, and so that's what we call in that dhyanam, or that anishtana, in that practice of bringing your experience back to yourself, bringing the rising up of the ahankara, which is really the dehatma buddhi, the bringing the rising up of the ahankara back to the aham, rising up back to the aham. And so that is just something that the shravana, manana, nididhyasana, Swamiji would always joke, how long do we have to do that? How long do we have to do that? Do I have to do it for a year or 2 years? So you're doing a 3-year course, Swamiji? Is that means that in 3 years I'll be enlightened? You know, all these kind of questions. And Swamiji would always say, it isn't like that, you know? It is what it is. This shravana, manana, nididhyasana resolves itself when it resolves itself.
that when your mind is clear, your mind is clear. When the doubts are clear, the doubts are clear. You know it. When the vision is clear, the vision is clear. You know. There's no doubt about it. Same with the doubts. It could be like this, or it could be like this, or it could be like that. There's kind of a time when your mind knows. And so any doubt that would come from anybody, it comes into your knowledge. It doesn't come into somebody who doesn't know. It comes into your knowledge, so there's no rising of the doubt. That Shravana Manana is complete. And then the Dehatma Buddhi, also, you experience that thinning out and thinning out and thinning out, because the Ahankara comes up less and less and less. But what do you do when it comes up? Well, when it comes up, it presents itself pretty radically. Right? You know when it's up. When it's not up, everything's fine and everything's Ishwar. There's no problem. You know? All is well. All is well. But then all is not well. All is well until all is not well. All is not well means the Ahankara has come. It's very simple, really. It's like jnana, the Ahankara has come. And so then what do? That jnana means you bring this experience back to yourself. That's nididhyasana. You can do it moment to moment to moment. You don't have to sit in meditation to do nididhyasana. You can sit in meditation and do nididhyasana. That's wonderful. But you can do it moment to moment to moment. You can do nididhyasana anytime the ahankara arises or an emotion rises or you're out into samsara. It can happen like that, and you can also bring it home like that too. And so that nididhyasana needs to be done until it doesn't need to be done. And it could also not need to be done most of the time. And then something happens and it needs to be done, you do it. That's all it is. But when you do that, when that's all clear, the knowledge is clear, and your mind is resolved into the self, then nisochati. That person does not grieve. Now, that nisochati, there's another way of understanding that too, which is, I think, the absolute truth of it. Once you know yourself, does your self grieve or not? But whose self grieves? Yourself, the Atma, that is Brahman, never grieves. It illumines grief. It can illumine grief. Right? But that's why contemplation is necessary, because the fact that the mind is having some grief, or the ahankara is lost in that grief, if there's an ahankara lost in the grief or lost in the experience, then that jhatva, jhanam, bringing the mind back, nididhyasana, bringing the mind back to yourself. Does the self grieve? That's the thing. Now, say the mind is grieving, or the mind has an emotion, or the mind has anger, or the mind has something that's going on in the mind. Is that going on in the self? I mean, literally, from your own experience at the moment, is the self grieving? Or is the mind angry? I mean, we're not going to go around talking about the mind is angry, you know, or the mind is sorrowful. No, that's not what I'm saying, because this is teaching now, so we don't have to worry about how we're talking, right? But say you have a sorrowful emotion or an agitated emotion or something going on in the mind. Is yourself still present? And who is grieving? So when you say, really, when you say nisochati, the Atma never grieves, it's because the self never grieves. If you say the Atma is never angry, it's because the self is never angry. The self is just what it is, Satchitananda Atma. That's all it is. It can't change. It doesn't have moods. The self is not moody. The self is not smart. The self is not stupid. It's not anything that exists within duality, any objectified state. So your being is always exactly the same. It's all the Satchit Atma, always exactly the same. And so these questions about does it grieve, or is it happy, or is it this, or is it that, is irrelevant. Nisarchatita, you could say, no, I never grieve. Yeah, but you look like you're grieving. You look like you're grieving, you know? You could say, well, yeah, I mean, my mind is feeling this way and that way, but I'm not. But you can't talk like that to people. You can only talk like that when you're teaching and trying to point something out, otherwise you sound like a loony. You can't say those kind of things. But that's the truth of it. You know, that person, the Sarchati, it does not grieve, and such a person is Vimuktaha, liberated here itself. Vimuktaha, because they say Vimuktaha Vimuchate. Vimuktaha means that such a person is liberated here itself, because I know myself. I know myself, it doesn't mean just an intellectual idea. It means as I'm walking and talking and living my life, I know who I am. Instead of the ahankara landing on my body, mind, sense organs, or my moods or emotions, the ahankara is mitya, and I am the aham. The word aham, the I, lands on me, on the self, which is Brahman. So that constant self is, that is me, is ever present. So that person, if you say, am I grieving, then I would have to be talking from the mitya ahankara to say yes. If I'm talking about me, I have to say no, because I'm not. Even though these experiences are going on. And so then you have to think like this. When I say experiences, or any objectified experience is mitya. Any experience I can objectify. That means all external experiences, and external only means external to my sense perception. External means I have the experience because of sense perception. That's what's external. Internal are those experiences that I have in my mind. And in fact, all experiences I have other than the self are in my mind, but I divide them into external and internal based upon whether they're generated by my sense organs or they're generated by the mind itself. For instance, emotions or imaginations or meditative states or all of the things that memories that the mind can do internally, not dependent upon sense perception. So we call those internal. But from the standpoint of the Atma, they're all external. They all are external. They're all subject to change. They're all part of the world of Maya. You know, and so all experiences, whether they be my emotional, mental, intellectual, meditative, all of these are Maya. The ahankara is Maya. The word aham is Maya. These are words. They all exist within samsara. But the word aham, for somebody who is gaining knowledge, lands upon the Atma, which is the only thing there is that is not objectifiable internally or externally. Right? So even internal is external. So if I'm looking at the whole creation that includes my body, mind, sense organs, and every experience that I have, all of that is Maya, all of that is Ishvara, and I am the Satchit Atma, that is really the one non-dual me that is the same in all beings. And I'm never changing at all. And so for me to say as a jnani that I'm moody or I'm this or that, if I say that, I'm talking from the mitya ahankara. I'm not talking about myself. That's just the reality, that's the reality of it. So that's why Swamiji can say, my mind does all kinds of funny things. And this is just such a beautiful quote of his. My mind does all kinds of funny things, so what? What does it mean? You know, it's like saying, gosh, the world keeps doing all these different things. Yes. Yes, it does. All kinds of things. Well, my mind is all kinds of things. Yeah, it does. But so what? Does it bother you? I mean, what is the problem? You know, how does it bother you? That it bothers me is that because there's an ahankara there, that it's not mitya. For me, the ahankara is not mitya for me. You know? When the whole thing is mitya, I can let Ishwar be. So such a person, that Nisochati, having taken the time, doing the dhyanam that's necessary to own all of this, then that person doesn't agree, grieve. That person is vimuktaha. What a cute little outfit. That person is vimuktaha, liberated. Here and now. That's why moksha is here and now. Even though you have all of these attachments and this and that, and all of this thing, you have your prarabdha, let me put it this way, not attachments, you've got your prarabdha karma, which is full of all kinds of things. So this prarabdha karma, you know, which goes on and on and on and on until it comes to an end, gives you a life with all kinds of responsibilities and all kinds of things. That goes on until it ends. But during it all, you are yourself. When the body drops, you are vimuchyate. You are liberated. I'm already liberated. That's right. But when the body drops, you don't take another one. So you are liberated from getting another physical body. You don't get another physical body. Because there's no reason to get a physical body, because you're already not the physical body. So there's nobody attached to that. So you are just simply Ishwara. You know, you're no longer the physical body that you never were in the first place. It's really what it amounts to. Let me just say something. Let's see something here. So Shankara says here, the person, having meditated, so he says, having done this anishtanam means the meditation on that one, Parameshwara, who is the one in the nine-gated city, having done that jnanam, preceded by vijnanam, samyak vijnanam, clear knowledge, then that one becomes liberated of all desire. So then he explains that a little bit more. So being, he says, sarva eshana vinir muktaha san, being liberated from all desire. Then he says, san samam, I had a typo there, I don't know if any of you others do it. Says san samam. So being liberated, then samam, then being liberated, that one is the same samam, sarva bhutastam, abiding in all beings with the one non-dual atma, is the idea. So having recognized that, meditated on that, myself is the one, Parameshwara, who is the same in all beings. He says, that person, Nisochati, does not grieve. Then he says, tad vijnanat, from that direct, immediate knowledge of the self, of the one who's abiding in the 11-gated city, abhaya praptehe, because of having attained abhayam, that state of fearlessness, which is only the non-dual self, even the slightest bit of duality, there is fear, Taittiriya Upanishad, even the slightest bit. So when you say abhaya, you mean really advaya. Abhaya, fearlessness, freedom from fear, is non-duality. So abhaya is advaya. So having attained that non-dual atma, then he says, shoka avasara abhavat, because there is an absence of any occasion, avasara, because there's an absence of any occasion for shoka, for sorrow, because of having gained that abhaya, that state of fearlessness, why? From the direct immediate knowledge of the self, tad vijnanat abhaya praptehe, shoka avasara abhavat, then he says, kutaha, from where is there any vision, bhaya iksha, where is there any vision or any experience of fear? Where does any experience of fear, any experience of sorrow, where does it come from? Why? Because there's no occasion for sorrow. No occasion for sorrow because of the attainment of that abhaya, of that non-duality, which arises from the direct recognition of the Parameshwara. This is another Mahavakya. The recognition of that self is the recognition of Parameshwara. Right? Because to recognize myself as Advaita, I have to recognize this whole creation as being nothing but me. And
form of Parameshwara. So then he says this, Iha eva avidya krita kama karma bandha nirvimuktaha bhavati. He becomes, or she becomes, someone who is bandhana, or vimukta, who is completely freed from the bandhana, from the bondage of kama and karma, of mm-hmm. desire and karma, which is brought about by avidya, by self-ignorance, here itself. So this is the vimuktaha. He becomes somebody who is completely free from kama and karma, which is born of avidya. So avidya means self-ignorance. If I have self-ignorance, I don't recognize myself as the source of ananda. The source of ananda is projected outward. It's projected outward, I desire it and go after it. My going after it is karma, my desire is kama. Both kama and karma are born of avidya, of self-ignorance. So I become freed of that here itself. And then he says, vimuktaschasana, vimuchate. And being liberated here itself, I am vimuchate. Means what? Punaha shariram na krinati. I never again take another body. Right? Because there's no reason for it. If the avidya is gone, the desire is gone, if the desire is gone, the karma is gone. There's no reason, there's no impetus for me to go and get anything because I already have everything I want. You know? Say if you're in a moment, say in samsara, if you're in love, if you're in a situation where you're with your beloved, that's what you want. You don't want it to end. There's not anybody saying, oh, no, that's not how you feel. You just want that to be there. Let it stay, let it stay, let it stay. So what if the nature of that love is your own swarupa, is the Atma swarupa? So when the mind has really dropped off all of the desires, which are really just nitya, they don't have anything, they're vacant. It's like the pot looking for something outside of the clay when all it wants is the clay. So what if when it gets the clay, the clay that's always been there, you get the ananda that you've always been seeking. And now that you have it, are you thinking, you know, that's not what it is. You just don't want, there's nothing that wants it to end. You just want to be that. That's what we're talking about. Otherwise, that's not moksha. You know, moksha, if you think that if you're bound, it's because I need this, I still need to do this, I want it to be like that. What if you have it as it is what you want it to be? I mean, really, not kind of want it to be, what you really want. And that's what you are. Now you recognize that. There's nothing in your upadis that want to veer from that. So when this body drops, the whole mind, body, sukshma sharira, has nowhere to go. It's already there. That's the thing. It's already there. There's nowhere for it to go because it's already there. And so they say is all of the subtle elements just go to the subtle elements, the physical elements go to the physical elements, and I just simply remain as Brahman. And Brahman is Ishwara. Ishwara is Brahman. In this way, that Maya doesn't belong to anybody else. Maya is the mitya, right? Swamiji's incidental attribute of me. You know, and so whatever Ishwara is, that's what I am. I know directly, immediately what I am as Brahman. What the form of the infinite Ishwara is inconceivable in a way, but then you know in a way also. You know in a way, but you can't visualize an infinite form. But then you experience that infinite form within this finite reality of your prarabdha. Where there's an infinity just within the small amount that you get to experience through your sense organs. You know, and so that you recognize as Ishwara. And that's enough. You can extend it infinitely, but you won't have that direct experience of infinite extension as long as you have this upadhi.
But when this illimited upadhi is gone, then whatever that mithya reality is yours, and the self that you are is the self that you are right now. So there's no change. That's why liberated, you are liberated. Because you don't take another body to come back into that limited state of ignorance. That's the idea. Okay, that's good enough of me. Om Tat Sat. Swasti prajabhya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah ko prananebhya shivamastu nityam lokha samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam shobharahitah Vamanasantu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
When we were talking about grief, and that there's no grief in Atman, in one's own being. You know, I sort of can see that. But we have a problem. I have a problem with grief being. How to say this? It never goes away. Once you have, say, a profound kind of grief, it sticks with you. It's forever there. Isn't that kind of the nature of grief? I mean, it does remain, right? That's what I'm asking about.
Well,
and so then you'd have to do this contemplation. I mean, I can see where there's no grief in Atma, but there's grief in mind. And when the mind has that experience, it seems to stay in that mind. It doesn't...
Forever, you think it stays?
I think so.
Well, you know, I think that there are some situations that bring about a deep grief, that then people have to spend time with that and learn how to kind of sublate it into other actions that help. You know, like if a child, if a person loses a child, like I know that my one sister-in-law lost her brother to muscular dystrophy. And so, and this is, I find this very common, and of course that was just heartbreaking to the family and to the parents. But then they spent their life working to help children who had muscular dystrophy, to raise funds for it and to do things, you know. somebody lost their child in war, which is a tragedy, you know. But so then what they started to do is working to help all veterans and people who were in that same situation to try to kind of transform that grief into something positive.
Yeah.
And so so these really profound griefs that seem to just stay with you as a sorrow becomes something that you use to do something positive. And so you're not overwhelmed by the grief. Even though, like, some people, one person lost their child at a very young age, and the child was still a baby. And that grief never has gone away, but it's not dominant. Mm-hmm. It's there. It's never going to not be there, because the love for the child was so much, and that child was lost unexpectedly. Like people say, you know, the child should never die first. The parent should die, not the child first. It's devastating for a parent. And so that grief is there, but then they learn how to give in ways that are healing. Even though that sorrow is there, it's not overwhelming, you know.
Well, in contemplation, you know, you're talking about it's the identity with the body, the Dehatma Buddhi. And contemplation helps that, because you can see that you're not body.
The thing is, you know, life is 50-50 in terms of the prarabdha karma. The grief itself, as are all emotions, you know, I was going to say, remember, prarabdha karma is 50-50. That means it's not a free ride. We all have a lot of things that have happened in life that have been hard. But all of those things are Ishwara. They all belong to the creation. Like Jagadish, I love the saying of his. Are you online, Jagadish? Brilliant. Okay, anyway, he always says something. This isn't Swarga Loka, you know.
Oh, yeah, well, I know that.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, Edward, is that somehow all of these experiences, good and bad, are kind of part of the mosaic of your life. Mm-hmm. And some of them are a lot harder than others, mm-hmm. some of the experiences. But you have to find a place for them and not let them be your life. Like, say, you have a tragedy, then your whole life is coming out of that tragedy. Or is the tragedy something that you're able to hold? If you're able to hold it, there's room for the self. You have a self, mm-hmm. you know, that then is holding the tragedy. But the tragedy also can be holding you. Mm-hmm. You know, and then when that's the case, some work has to be done in order to reverse that.
Yeah, but do we extend that to the body? I mean, the body seems to hold me rather than me hold the body. I mean, that sense of I am the body is pretty...
Well, that's why they say Nididhyasana is for Dehatma Buddhi, the conviction that I am the body.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's why we have to do Nididhyasana, because that viveka has to be there.
Yeah.
Because from the standpoint of the body, you are the body. But from the standpoint, because the body enjoys conscious being, but you are also absolutely free from the body. So you have to be able to recognize that too. So from the standpoint of the body enjoys you completely. But from the standpoint of you, you are free of the body. So
yeah.
This has to be seen.
Yeah.
If it's not seen, then you're the body. That's the samsari. Yeah, that's why, even with all of this knowledge, so much shravana and mana, the samsari is still there in terms of the Dehatma Buddhi. Mm-hmm. So that's why in this verse they say, you know, having meditated, the person does not grieve. Because even though they have some jnanam, even though it's a clear vision, still they're not living that, because that Dehatma Buddhi is there. Mm-hmm. And for that is Nididhyasana.
So you can do this contemplation, but that conviction that I am the body is resolved in this way, that you can recognize that it's mitya, even though it's still...
Yes, but remember, when you recognize anything as mitya, that means that you're at the same time recognizing the satyam.
Yeah.
If you're not recognizing yourself, the truth of yourself, then you're not recognizing this as mithya.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's the thing. We can't really even legitimately use the word mithya without recognizing the satyam. Like I can't say, oh, see that snake? You know, that snake is really, that snake is mithya. Yeah, you know, that's not.
You need the satyam.
Yeah, you have to say, you know, that snake is really a rope. I mistook it, you know. Now I see the rope. Then you can say it's mithya. Yeah.
And so
the word is meaningless.
So is that where they said jesting that that's a daily practice about taking care of this identity with the body?
Yeah, it's a daily practice until it's just the how it is.
So
that's why Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. How long, Swamiji? He'll joke, you know. How long, Swamiji? And that's just a... You'll know.
So how does that mechanism... You live out that mechanism on a daily basis, and is there a mechanism involved, or...?
Well, if you say Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana, Shravana means you're studying the Shastra. You're going to class. Manana means you're doing that work that happens in class also, where you, if you have doubts, then you're bringing the doubts up and you're resolving them. Nididhyasana happens in class, hopefully. You know, there's what's supposed to happen in class, where you see, you know, there's moments of seeing. That's Nididhyasana, and you also practice that, like if you have a daily meditative practice, until it's always only Nididhyasana. When it's nothing but Nididhyasana, then you don't have to practice Nididhyasana, because that's the reality.
Mm-hmm.
If you're practicing Nididhyasana, it's because you're bringing your mind back to that reality. And if you're not bringing your mind back, it means that's already how you are. So you're always doing Nididhyasana. Like in that approaching of buddhi, which we have to do that sometime, the last part of it, Shankara says, do I have to really sit to do Nididhyasana? I am Nididhyasana. The Atma itself, the self itself is Nididhyasana. And when are you not there? So that's nishta. That's assimilated knowledge, you know. But that takes some time. You know, and it takes time not for you, for the self. It takes time for the different parts of the body, that means the unconscious and different habits that we have and just the ahankara and all these things. You know, all of it has to just keep rising up into your knowledge. Because now you are different. Your buddhi is different. It has knowledge.
Yeah.
But then there's all of these vrittis, you know, that have been generated, or riffs, like musical riffs, you know, of thinking, grooves in the brain that need to be rerouted. It takes some time.
And you referred to that as being kind of an alertness. Swamiji said it was kind of an alertness.
Well, you know, I mean, Swamiji, he was very alert, and he also... He was committed to doing that work completely.
Yeah.
But then he didn't have a lot of other things he was having to deal with, work on, because, you know, to make you not committed. Because if you have a lot of pain in your mind or tragedies have happened in your life, then you feel justified in feeling miserable all the time around that. This happened to me, you know. That's a big fat ahankara. That's a giant ahankara. It's not that easy to get around it. This happened to me, you know. And then to be in mourning over what happened to you, and there's a justification around that. And so that takes some growth and maturing for that, not becoming from that position, you know. And to have this knowledge be in the forefront. And for Swamiji, this knowledge was, he never compromised it. If there was something going on in him that compromised his knowledge, boom, he was right on top of it. That's how he was. That's why he said at the end of his life, you know, I worked hard for this knowledge. to have the level, what did he mean? He meant to have that level of nishta and that level of maturity. He didn't compromise. He was on it, you know, and it was the most important thing to him. Even when he was a young man, it was the, and being, going from this stupid thing to this one to this things that were not really what he needed. He finally got what he needed, and he had studied so much and meditated so much and done everything he possibly could. And then he got it because he got what he needed. And then it was finished. And then it was just a matter of, in terms of knowledge, it was a matter of, for him, of just being really alert. He was alert more than most of us. He cared more than most of us about gaining that type of mastery over his mind. Mm-hmm. And so he said, you know, it's not like I didn't do those things. Mm-hmm. I did all of those things. And that's why he didn't say any words, but that's what he did. He would say something like, and that's why I have this level of nishtha that I have.
So there's no easy street then? I
mean, there's no easy street, but we don't have to necessarily think of it as hard either.
Ah.
You know, it's a matter of diligence because it's what you want. It's what the most important thing is.
Yeah.
You know?
So once he got it, the thing that he was doing, being...
maturing?
Yeah.
Or knowledge?
Well, once he had knowledge, then what he was doing was nididhyasana to gain nishtha.
You can take it as kind of a broad term of nididhyasana, because actually the problem is that dehatma buddhi. That's the ahankara, right? So in a way, all of the bringing your mind back, all of your values, even the values that mani tuma dambi tuma himsa chanti arjavan, this all in chapter 13, this list of the values, all of those are just these particular pitfalls in the mind and bringing knowledge to those. So instead of manitram, a manitram. Instead of dambitram, a dambitram. Instead of himsa, a himsa. Mm-hmm. And so when you find your mind behaving in this way, you see that, you work on it.
Yeah.
It's not that you see that and then you say, well, I'm so angry because this person is this and that, and they shouldn't do that. That's what I'm working on then. It's all a justification. You can justify all you want, but that's all samsara. You can bring your mind back and see all of this as Ishwara, see it as the prarabdha, the karma, and just enjoy your own presence. And look at the incredible wonder of Ishwara that is not all that easy either. I mean, Ishwara is not easy. So even Ishwara will say, Dharma will protect you from this creation which has everything going on.
And that's the same, that's true also towards the unconscious thing. I mean,
the unconscious is also objectified when it comes to you, then you have to, yes. It's not the Dharma, you know?
Yeah.
But what is Dharma, really? It's a golden rule. It's ahimsa. But even to put more meat on ahimsa, it's, you know, we all know what Dharma is in reference to how we want others to treat us. We know. But we have desires. And so desires get in the way of our treating other people how we know we want to be treated. But Dharma is innate because we know how we want to be treated. It's just part of the law. It's built into us. But we also have self-ignorance. You know, and the self-ignorance causes this issue of these desires. And the desires are painful because when I have a desire, I'm projecting myself out there and now I have to get myself back. I have to get my ananda back is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and so I compromise my dharma and then I get myself into trouble.
Yeah.
So a dharma is never worth it, and you just, Bhagavan keeps relentlessly teaching that. You know, you can't work around it. Because once an adharma is there, you get the immediate result on an emotional level. Even if it doesn't work out on a physical, you don't, what you wanted, you end up getting. You don't get what you wanted on an emotional level because of the adharma. And so those are the laws that keep us growing. Because what if adharma was really rewarded? Yeah. It may be seemingly awarded on like a physical level, but it won't be awarded internally. So that's what keeps us all growing and maturing and becoming eventually mamokshas. How are we doing here? Another question? Thanks for the question about grief, Edward. So Ignani can release grief faster because of viveka or... Oh. I think, because of viveka in the sense of I have a source of ananda that is the salve for the mind or the sanctuary for your mind. Your mind has a place to go. It has Ishwara and it has the self. I find it hardest lately when I think about people close to me who are older, who themselves are anxious and sad about dying. I don't know what to say to comfort them without sounding abstract. Yeah, I know, you can't say, there's not much you can say except be empathic. Sometimes there's an opening. Depends on your relationship with that person. Sometimes you can talk to them about how they're feeling, what they think really happens. Sometimes I would say things like, well, you know, in India they don't believe that there's any death experience at all. This is what they say. But then you have to have different kinds of openings. One thing is that when a person dies, at that time that they're dying, they realize there's no death, so it's all fine. Mm. There is no death experience at all. And there's also an experience of extreme, I think, ananda, at least momentarily, because it's a release into kind of the imprisonment of the physical body, which you don't even think of when you're embodied. But when you're released from that, it's an amazing thing. Even momentarily, you can have experiences like that. Sometimes you can ask them what they really think happens after death. But it depends. Like if you have a relationship with them where they're comfortable talking to you about it and you make yourself available as a good listener who really wants to know what they're going through. Okay, everybody.